Welcome to the History of South Africa podcast with me, your host, Des Latham. This is episode 182. And by the way, 182 is a triangular number, meaning it can be arranged into an equilateral triangle. Specifically, it is the 13th triangle number, because 13 times 4 divided by 2 is 182. And it's a death triangle that the British were now facing. A Maxhosa prophecy, a blazing hot environment, not conducive to their style of war, and the Maxhosa chiefs who were stacking up against the invaders. When we left off, the British column under Lieutenant Colonel George McKinnon was trying to make it back to Fort White, having been whipped by the Maxhosa in the Bomber Pass. It's important to note that of the 12 British soldiers killed up to that point, all were shot. Previously, in the first 7 frontier wars, most soldiers were stabbed by Maxhosa-wielding assegais, but now the boot was on the other foot, so to speak. And yet, in the coming months of war, the Maxhosa would use their trusty assegais to good effect, as you're going to hear. So it's Boxing Day, 1850, a year in which the transportation of British convicts to Western Australia had begun, just as it was being phased out in other parts of that territory. In June 1850, former twice-served British Prime Minister Sir Robert Peel fell off his horse and died. Meyer Lehman sailed from Germany to join his two brothers in the United States, who were running a dry goods business, a precursor to the doomed Lehman Brothers Bank, which collapsed in 2007 and took the world's economy with it. Also in the United States of 1850, Edward Rolfe May delivered a speech to the Indiana legislature, where he called for African Americans to be given the right to vote. This was a period when slavery was still legal in America, 10 years before the Civil War. In southern Africa, McKinnon's men had been shot at through Christmas by Sandile's warriors, who imbued with Prophet Mlanjeni's magic, and now the troops were trying to escape what looked like certain doom. They'd bivouacked overnight at the Uniondale Mission Station at Kaiskamahook, the mountains of the Amatola. It hadn't helped that McKinnon stuck to his original orders like a limpet to a rock. Governor Sir Harry Smith had ordered that the men should march with firearms unloaded to avoid any accidents. This despite the fact that a large army of Maxhosa were now tailing the British as they force-marched to Fort White. The muskets remained unloaded, at least at first. If you recall last episode, missionary Robert Niven, along with Tu Osoga and both their families, had decided to seek shelter in the opposite direction to the British march. We'll get back to what happened to them next episode. But first, to the philandering missionary George Brown's home at Iqibira. The disgraced Scotsman left his young wife Janet with their baby and rode to the Tumi Mission, ostensibly to attend an inquiry into his behaviour on Christmas morning. His behaviour included his liaisons with Xhosa women. He didn't know about the start of the 8th Frontier War on that very day. Janet, his wife, lay in bed feeding their baby alone when her Xhosa maid ran in saying large numbers of warriors were passing the station. Both stood at the door and watched in astonishment at the passing men. Then a messenger arrived from Mbalu Chief Stokwe, warning that, in his words, the land is dead, and she should leave immediately.
"I cannot go until Mr. Brown is back," she countered.
"You must go before sunset," retorted the messenger.
Janet Brown wrote a letter to her husband explaining what had happened, handed it to one of the Xhosa workers, and asked him to take that to Tumi Mission Station. And in Tumi, missionary Cumming had already heard that there'd been a battle in Bomber Pass. He was told that the military villages were on fire. 3 coloured Cape Mounted Rifles horsemen galloped up with a note from Harry Smith, asking whether Cumming needed firearms and ammunition. "No," said the missionary. A startling reply, but Cumming knew that a couple of muskets against thousands of Maxhosa warriors would be useless, and also possibly his death warrant. Chief Ngika, after all, had called Tumi a sanctuary. The buildings had been burned down in the previous war, but none of the missionaries had been attacked personally. Any firearms there would be a death sentence at this stage. This was 3 years later. Much water had flowed under the bridge. In nearby Woburn, for example, homes that had been built at Ngika's warrior son Charlie's grave were under threat.
As you've heard, the ex-British soldiers living there had opened up and desecrated the grave. For the Ngqika line of the Amararabi people, this military village would be their first main target. The Amangqika had watched the vets till their land, farm their land. They lived cheek by jowl, the land that was of their ancestors. The little river between Woburn and the Amangqika was easy to cross, except when in full spate, and it wasn't that day on Christmas in 1850, when a large Amaxhosa army crossed the river and laid waste to Woburn, which they attacked at 9 in the morning. 16 ex-soldiers farmed here, some with families. They were all overrun in less than an hour. The women and children were spared, the men speared or shot. The nearby military village of Auckland was attacked at 2 in the afternoon. It lay in a bowl at the head of the Tumi River Valley. This was a trap from which none of the soldiers would escape. There was no clear view down into the valley, which meant they had no idea what was taking place. They could not see the smoke from Woburn and also the other little village of Johannesburg. When a Khoi Khoi woman struggled up the path on Christmas morning and told the inhabitants of Auckland that she had spotted smoke from the other villages, she was ignored. Then 3 Khoi Khoi soldiers arrived, bearing news from Fort Hare that the Amaxhosa were on the warpath. But still, this little village did not believe it. You can see why, because one of the warrior chiefs, Kaimpi, was actually inside Auckland village already. He'd wandered in with his men, which he'd done before, and was well known. He watched the settlers playing a game of cricket. It was Christmas Day, after all. Kaimpi drank some coffee he was offered, chatted away with one of the settler wives. Then he threw the dregs from his cup, stood up, and gave the Amaxhosa war whistle, and the warriors assegaied most of the men dead immediately. A few managed to escape with the women and children, rushing into a solid building sans roof designed to protect them in just such a situation. The warriors flung large rocks over the walls, but the surviving soldiers fired back. The warriors retreated. Kaimpi appeared in the distance, saying that the women and children should leave the building. It was the men who should do the fighting. A handful of the settler wives refused to leave, but the men inside realized this was futile and convinced them to save themselves. They left. After the warriors stripped them of their dresses and clothes, the woebegone group of women and children began their long march down to the Tumi Mission. And thus, the trail of retribution and death passed up the Tumi Valley. Across the other side of the Amatola Mountains, the British troops, who'd managed to make it out of Boma Pass, then marched off from Kaiskamahook, heading to Fort Watt. They were suffering in the midsummer heat. This was now Boxing Day. They were dressed in their red coats, heavy belts, no proper hats. The attack on them had started at 5 in the morning, just after they left Uniondale Mission Station, and it was going to continue until late that afternoon. The few hundred soldiers in McKinnon's column moved in the same order as before, with one exception. The Khoi Khoi cavalrymen, the Cape Mounted Rifles, were in the rear, while McKinnon rode at the front with the Amaxhosa police. McKinnon had every confidence in this group of former enemy soldiers. Other officers were not so sure. As they moved over the Kaiskamma near the summit of the Amatolas, away from Uniondale, the officers and men following in the column began noticing packages of British ammunition being dropped by the Khoza police. Other packages were being placed on top of rocks along the trail. The ancient Khoza tradition of leaving a rock on cairns as they passed seemed to have morphed into a new tradition of leaving ammunition. A present for their brethren, Sandile and Imlanjeni's warriors, creeping along following the column. The British could hardly afford to leave all their important ammunition just lying around, because they'd lost at least 3,500 rounds in the Boma Pass debacle. Lieutenant G. Armitage of the 6th Regiment, who'd been charged with protecting the ammunition the day before, ordered his men to pick up the gifts strewn across the track. The wounded, meanwhile, were having a rough time, including Lieutenant Bissett, who'd been shot by the Amaxhosa in Boma Pass. Before collapsing from his wound, he'd had a major impact on the battle. By dint of his courage, he'd saved many of his compatriots, while the Lieutenant Colonel McKinnon appeared all at sea. Unfortunately for this column now, McKinnon was unable to call on the tactical talents of Bissett, who was lying in a blanket, being carried along by 4 men, staggering under his weight. Each step shot sharp stabs of pain through Bissett's body. At least 20 other wounded men were being carried in this way. It was torturous, this journey. The British troops were literally boiling in their redcoats. They had run out of water. Some said it was so hot that the varnish on their peaked forage caps melted and ran down their cheeks. Mid-morning, McKinnon called a halt at possibly one of the worst places he could have picked on the entire trail. It was a glade, an open area, but surrounded by thick bush. As they sat down, some without their knapsacks, which they'd thrown away, the Amakhosa opened fire. Breakfast was forgotten. The British returned fire, and McKinnon's choice of bivouac meant the troops could not properly defend their position. It was counterattack, run or die. So they decided to run through the narrow glade, with the Amakhosa hidden behind bushes and rocks, letting rip with their muskets. It was, in a word, a panic. Bissett wrote later, at this moment there was a little haste and confusion, a typically understated comment by a British officer bleeding on a stretcher while his enemy made merry with their muskets. The stretcher bearers dropped Bissett in this little haste and confusion and ran away, leaving him to have his throat cut by the Amakhosa. Amanika chief Sandile knew exactly who Bissett was, and the British officer's head was worth quite a bit of honour. So he began pulling himself through the grass to escape certain death. The cavalry was trying to pass, but some of the horses were shot and the riders dismounted. This saved Bissett's life. A Khoi Khoi sergeant by the name of Eckstein spotted him crawling along. "My God, sir, is that you?" he asked.
"Yes, Eckstein, don't leave me."
The English soldiers were in flight. After more jostling and shouting, the officers pulled the men back towards themselves. Discipline was restored, the column rallied, but now the number of wounded had doubled. Luckily for these men, the Khoi Khoi Cape mounted rifles were at the back. They were crank shots and began peppering the Amakhosa hiding along the trail with carefully aimed shots. Sandile's warriors tried to outflank the column, but a withering fire from the cavalry stopped them in their tracks. And the battle stories of Sandile began to spread amongst the British troops. He appeared to be everywhere. He was riding Armitage's horse. Then he popped up wearing a red-lined blue military cloak. Where was he? Everywhere, went the narrative after this clash. The British troops were famished. They hadn't eaten. The Amakhosa were harrying this column, chipping away at the troops, chopping it up. The soldiers began wavering once more. The stretcher bearers came in for a particularly accurate fire. Some wondered whether they should drop their wounded again and run for it. The fighting intensified as this ragged column approached Fort White. A short distance from the fort, perhaps a kilometre, they came across a terrifying sight. A large party of British soldiers sent from the fort to recon the bush had been killed to a man, massacred. Then their bodies had been arranged so that McKinnon's column would come across them. The British troops would finally crack, thought the Amakhosa. But no, the corpses were picked up, all 20, and carried into the fort by the bedraggled group of bleeding soldiers. Horrified by their experience, and yet the terror was not over. Fort White was tiny, and if you remember my previous podcast, it was not defended by artillery. The massacre of more than half the garrison outside meant there were now only 17 men inside, who'd been joined by 150 to 200 troops trying to fight off more than 1,000 Amakhosa warriors armed with muskets and assegais. After McKinnon made it into the fort, he took stock. The veld around was strewn with Amakhosa dead and wounded, which vanished overnight. The Khoza carried the bodies away. Meanwhile, Cape Governor Harry Smith was in Fort Cox, close to the Kaiskama River. Smith had been outmatched and outthought by the Amanglika chief he regarded as a savage. Sandile and Makoma and Mlanjeni had taught the bombastic British governor a lesson. By late Christmas afternoon, December 1850, Smith was already unsure if he would survive. Missionary Charles Brownlee's wife wrote later that bitter must have been his awakening. Fort Cox had been surrounded by Amanglika Khoza. Half the garrison was sent to collect water. There were so many warriors around, and half a dozen British were shot or assegaied on the first dangerous mission. The worm had turned. The only hope of salvation now lay with a man called Henry Somerset. He was based at Fort Hare,
But if you've listened to the series, you'll recall that Henry Somerset, son of Charles, had issues. Somerset Jr. was regarded as a loose cannon, not to be trusted. And here he was, the possible savior of the situation for the English. Smith was holed up in the fort in British Kaffraria, far away from any help. How was he to manage the situation? Ironically, he turned to a friendly Xhosa messenger. Here is the dichotomy of history, the irony in our lives, the strange but true logic of reality. Smith had to ask a black messenger to save his entire empire from collapse in the Eastern Cape. But of course, easier said than done. He needed to find someone with the courage, the fortitude, and the endurance to make the 60-kilometer dash from Fort Hare to Grahamstown to spread the word of martial law. This man, we will never know his name, was found. And it was he who spread the word throughout the Eastern Cape regions. All male inhabitants were now called up. All soldiers in Cape Town had to be shipped to East London. All males had to mobilize, including those in the Cut River settlement, and all the coloureds within the Cape Colony. The terrible fear clung over the territory like a dark mist. As the sun set, the first refugees had staggered into towns, stumbling over the logs and the rocks in the dark, semi-naked women and children. 30 of these from Auckland, including 3 Khoi Khoi soldiers who'd warned the people who'd been ignored. Damaqosa had spared their lives, but taken their horses and also stripped them naked. In King Williamstown, George McKinnon's headquarters, the soldiers and citizens were in a tiz. 400 settlers lived here, and as the sun set, the Amatola signal fires began to blaze on the ridges of the Amatolas. In Grahamstown, the streets were cordoned off by nightfall, barricades erected, every man put under arms, muskets, sabres, pistols. Some of the denizens here were less than honourable and fled, hiring wagons and escorts, paying massive rates, a kind of VIP bodyguard hired to protect the fearful nouveau riche as they put their tails between their legs and dashed down to Port Elizabeth. While all of this was going on back in Auckland, that little military village, 9 men lay inside the roofless building waiting for dawn and death. It was Boxing Day. They had fired at the Amatosa for most of the afternoon of Christmas Day. They watched their homes being burned down that night. They were showered by stones and rocks flung by the warriors, but they were still alive, not for long. As dawn broke, the lights suffused with hope, and an awakening of another day, the ammunition ran out, their firing stopped. Then the Amatosa closed in, and it was over in seconds. This was the start of something we know as the 8th Frontier War. But it's more than that. It would become the second longest war in South African history after the Anglo-Boer War. 27 long months of fighting awaited a territory riven by 7 former wars. These 7, you can say, were a precursor to the main event. Sandile's War, Mlanjeni's War. This was going to test everyone. Amaxhosa, settler, British soldier, Khoi Khoi, Boer. The effect of this war has cascaded to the present. Next episode, we'll also hear about what was going on in Southern Africa in early 1851. Please rate the podcast on your favourite channel and head off to the website desmondlatham.blog and sign up for my newsletter. As I said previously, I'm making a few changes, including a relocation. So bear with me in the next week or two with that website. It's taking a little time to update it. Until next, Salagadli.